Thierry, good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Good.
You brought in a huge coffee table book that I'm looking at with Painted Wolves, A Wild Dog's Life
Painted
by Nicholas
Wolves.
Dyer
yes.
and Peter Blinston.
Mm-hmm. Second most endangered carnivore in Africa.
Yeah.
So the most endangered carnivore is the Ethiopian wolf, mm-hmm. which I've also had the fortunate pleasure of going to go and visit.
Yeah.
Wild dogs are incredible animals. You know, the more you read about them, the more that you, if you've had the pleasure of working with them.
Yes.
Sometimes things do go wrong. Mm-hmm. We were moving wild dogs up to Tswalu in the Kalahari, mm-hmm. and we stopped at the filling station. It was in Freiburg, I think. And the fellow's eyes were quite large because the dogs, the crates they'd put the dogs in weren't that good and the dogs were busy eating their way out the crates.
Oh, my goodness.
and yeah, you know, I think when you read about them and when you understand them and you look at wild dogs in a company, there was we did a talk for a long time, wild dogs in your company. And one of the most incredible things is that in every wild dog in every part of the pack has got a function. And everybody contributes.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the most amazing things that they do. There are some things that they've discovered lately as well, which, you know, it was always said that there was the alpha male and female that were breeding.
And yet.
Fred's been in there as well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So some of the pups that you're busy finding. Yeah,
yes.
yeah. Papa ain't who Papa thinks he is.
Yeah, maybe postman's kid.
Yeah, so yeah, incredible creatures. All right. Absolutely.
Well, you know what? We are, of course, also going to be talking to, we do have actually Nicholas Dyer on the line, wildlife photographer and nature conservationist. So maybe we can kick off our conversation with Nicholas, just talking about that pack structure, right, that you alluded to in our introduction.
I think it's incredible. I mean, yeah, maybe Nicholas can give us a bit of a better brief on his wild dogs in Zimbabwe.
Absolutely. So if you've just joined us today in the Nature Corner, talking to Tim Neary, of course, and Nicholas Dyer, one of the authors of Painted Wolves, A Wild Dog's Life, taking a look at the wolves and finding out more about the work of Nicholas Dyer. Good morning, Nicholas. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very, very well. Thank you. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. A nice early start for Sunday, which is great.
It's always great to start off early on a Sunday. So you are, of course, the co-author of this book, Painted Wolves, A Wild Dog's Life, which was described by Sir Richard Branson as a fascinating journey into the lives of the painted wolves and what is being done to save them. Tell me very briefly, Nicholas, about the book and the process of putting this this beautiful coffee table book together.
Yeah, it's been a long journey. I first went to Mana Pools in Zimbabwe, which is on the Zambezi River, mm-hmm. Back in 2013.
Yeah.
And Mana Pools is the only park in Africa which allows you to walk on foot. And at the time, I obviously didn't have those skills, but a guide said, "Do you want to come walking with me and follow these dogs on the hunt?" And it was just the most incredible thing to see them hunt, to see them, the pack work together. And that was in 2013. And since then, I've probably spent about 400 days with them. My skills of following them have got far better. My photography's got better.
Mm-hmm.
And I put together this book with leading Zimbabwean conservationist Peter Blinston, mm. who runs Painted Dog Conservation.
Yeah.
But it's been an incredibly long journey.
Mm. Nicholas, why the name Painted Wolves? Why have they been called that?
That's a very, very good question. I think, you know, for everybody in South Africa and us in Africa, I'm originally from Kenya, we know them as wild dogs. But in the rest of the world, they're not known as any creature. They're not known at all. And when they do get to know them as wild dogs, they just think they're some kind of feral animal that is that has escaped from a town or one of our mutts gone wild. Whereas the reality is they're a totally different species. They're not even, they're a canid, but they're not part of Canis, which are dogs and coyotes and jackals are. They're Lycaon, which is a totally separate species. And so Lycaon pictus does mean painted wolf, if you translate it. And, you know, we believe that in the rest of the world, these unknown animals, which are in so much danger, have a far better reception when they're called painted wolves. And it coincided at a time when the BBC, I don't know whether you saw it, produced this incredible film called Dynasties. And they decided to call them Painted Wolves. And yet there's no conservation organization until we set one up that would actually when people heard of, you know, potentially a billion people saw this film, would then actually say, gosh, what's a painted wolf? And so we set up a conservation organization and did the book on the same dogs to actually help something to keep these guys alive.
Mm. Why so endangered?
Well, it goes back to 100 years ago. There was probably about 500,000 wild dogs right across Africa. And then they were considered vermin. And so, I mean, I'm not sure what the policy is here, but in Zimbabwe, if you shot one and took in a tail to the district commissioner, you were actually given 20 shillings. And so they were, there was a systematic program to eradicate them, which didn't end until the late 1970s. And since then, they've become protected. But the problem is that they are still caught in snares, roadkills. They get a lot of disease from rabies, which they catch off domestic dogs. So, I mean, they're just under continual threat, not to mention their normal threats and manageable threats, which are lions and hyenas.
Mm. Nicholas, what are the conservation approaches that you're taking in the Painted Wolf Foundation?
I think the first thing, which I alluded to before, was to raise awareness of this species because nobody knows them. And what we're trying to do is to, you know, there's 6,500 left in the wild, and that compares to say 450,000 elephants or even 25,000 rhinos. That's not to say that, you know, the painted wolf is more important than the rhino and the elephant, but these are very seriously endangered. So to build awareness and just to get them up onto the top table of conservation is one of our key goals. The other is to raise funds and support for all the organizations that are working to save the dogs on the ground. And we kind of, one of the most effective ways of saving them is really education, not just globally, but also among the people and communities that have to live with them, because, you know, the threats, the myth of the threats that have been built up about them of being wanton killers of animals and livestock, of attacking humans, are generally pretty much false.
Yeah, I think you know, you made that comment about being shot on sight, etc. And interestingly enough, the wild dog was one of the only animals that even our own national parks shot on sight. Because of
their, the same reasoning?
Yeah, their ferocious killing ability and the fact that they just decimate, as far as they were concerned, anything in sight. And then, of course, you also mentioned that word rabies. And even coming from Kenya, that was a huge issue for you guys at one point where they almost wiped out trying to help the dogs, giving them the incorrect rabies inoculations.
Yeah, that's right. That was up in Laikipia. I mean, it was a great tragedy because there weren't that many dogs there. But then, through good conservation efforts, there was they got up to a population of 300 dogs across Laikipia, which is a great, you know, for only 6,500 in the world, that's a significant population. But from domestic dogs, you know, came distemper. It was actually that actually just wiped out about 90% of their population. They're recovering a bit now, but that is one of the programs that we support is to actually vaccinate domestic dogs with anti-rabies and, you know, drugs.
Incredible jaws as well. When you look at one of the photographs you guys have got in the book where you look at the wild dog with a collar around its neck, you've got spikes, etc. on the collar. They'll happily just chew their own collars off.
What that is that that collar was developed by Painted Dog Conservation in Zimbabwe. And the spikes that come out the collar are actually designed to help the dog get out of the snare.
Ah, yes.
Uh-huh. The snare goes round the neck. And then when they fight, they just cut it cuts deeper into their throat, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And so with it round the spikes, they can actually wriggle their way through. And so it has saved a lot of dogs' lives.
Yeah, because earlier we with Sirtrack as well, they also developed a very wide collar for exactly the same reason. The distance that they cover is quite incredible, isn't it?
Absolutely. And they vary from pack to pack. So the ones I was following in Manapul was not huge, perhaps about 100 square kilometers, because there was plenty of food there. And I was really quite pleased with that, because generally I was following them on foot. But the ones in the Kalahari, I understand, you know, they can cover thousands, of, you know, a couple of thousand square kilometers. And there's collared dogs, you know, with tracking devices in Botswana that ended up in Zimbabwe very recently. And two conservation organizations talk to each other so they could say, we've got some dogs on their way to you.
That's lovely. Nice.
Nicholas, the conflict between man and the dogs, from the point of view of farming in places like Zimbabwe, etc., is that manageable?
I think it is. I think one is to sort of like display the myth. One of the nice, because the dogs move in such wide ranges, is that it's kind of, they don't, like where I am, where they eat the impala, they don't deplete a whole herd. They will take one and then move on and then go get another herd and take one. So they are ferocious and incredibly efficient killers, mm-hmm. but they kind of manage their they don't go in and decimate a whole herd. They'll just take one, move on to the next herd, and somehow that's quite good conservation practice. I think the problem comes more if you have one denning and you've got a lot of animals. So there's two things that I think worry there. If you know your goats are going, one is education, that you know they're not as bad as is made out. The other is, how do those communities or farmers that have to live with them get compensated for any losses of livestock that they receive? And there are either through conservation efforts, like I know Painted Dog Conservation, for instance, builds boreholes, has huge educational bush camps and so forth to support the communities, which is really given by the dogs in an indirect way. The other is, how can tourism help so that another income can come in? You know, because a lot of people increasingly really want to see these animals because they're so exciting to watch. Yeah.
Well, talk us through we alluded to the pack structure earlier on when we started the conversation, but, you know, run us through the pack structure and what it is personality-wise or in terms of that traits that that you find so exciting about these animals.
Yeah, well, I think one of the most lovely things, they do live in packs. Vary in size from just 5 right up to 30 or even more. But they're incredibly social animals. So mm-hmm. they, as well as fantastic hunters, they love to play. They really bond with each other. They really take a lot of time taking care of the pups. Each of them has a role. I think, Tim, you alluded to this before in one of the packs in Yakasanga I followed. You know, they were the incredible hunters. They were the babysitters. There was even one lovely little yearling called Triss, who seemed, whenever an animal got wounded, she would go up and actually lick all the wounds. So we called her Doc. So the incredible thing is that it's the whole pack, and this is what may make them so nice, is run by an alpha female. She is the boss. She is the general. She is in charge. She's also the caring mother. So, you know, it is very much a matriarchal society, and they don't compete. Lions, when they compete with each other over food, are very aggressive, whereas the dogs tend to compete with each other with submission. So they sort of beg for a share of the food as opposed to try and fight it off one or the other, you know, another one. Mm. So they're actually really nice.
I think there's one thing that they made a bit of a mistake in the design feature with the dog, though. No matter what you do, they stink.
Yeah, if you, I used to go to take some of my pictures. I went to the den. I don't like going there because it's, you know, it can actually disturb them. But I had this massive long lens of about 1,250 millimeter lens. And even at the distance I was from the hole, if the wind was blowing the wrong way, It was a very unpleasant few hours, I can tell you.
Okay, so you have to describe this for us. Give us a sense of what it is or closely related to, smell-wise, and why, actually. Do we know why?
I do know. The smell-wise, as I can only just say, is revolting. I mean, you know, it's not very much at all. But what they do is that they often roll in dead animals, or they roll in dung or whatever, almost to disguise them. Uh-huh. I once witnessed that dog, Trish. She actually regurgitated some impala, then rolled in it, and then another dog called Amos
started chills on my spine.
Regurgitated and then rolled in it. So that I can only say, imagine what that must smell like, and that probably best describes it. And I'm sorry if I put anyone off their breakfast.
Yeah, I think it's actually quite interesting because the Anne van Dyck Centre had one of the wild dogs that was born.
Yes.
There was a little problem with it, so they thought they would bring it up as an ambassador. It was bathed daily. It even used to stand and wait for its bath. And wild dogs love water. They love bathing in the water, etc. It didn't matter. Within 2 hours, there's a smell gland and they stink.
And
there's
just
no other word.
That smell.
Yeah, we moved some once with a sponsored vehicle.
Yeah.
They had to replace the carpets in the back.
My goodness.
No, it's unbelievable. A wild dog smell is unique.
Yeah.
There's no other word for it. Yeah, it's not something you're going to bottle and try and sell
on a Sunday. Or it's just a fantastic idea for some kind of chemical or biological warfare, right?
Yes,
that's
yeah.
Inspiration
but
right
talking
there.
Talking of that, have you had successes or have you guys had trials with utilizing the scats, etc., as barriers? Where because they were doing it at one stage up in the Venetia area where they were putting out the wild dog scats using that as a barrier.
I've heard that. So I know Derek of Endangered Wildlife Trust in the Waterberg, he's had some great success with that, and I know that Tico McNutt in Botswana has also been working with that, and also. That has helped, and I think Tico has been doing a lot of research in pheromones and so on and so forth to actually try and create barriers to farmland. Derek actually used lion scat, which he put around the boundaries of unwelcoming farmers, and they actually moved them to get away from there. So I think it's early days, but there's a lot of good work being done in that area to try and control them. But that also requires an enormous amount of work, a lot of funds to be able to to actually be, the manpower to put it in, but also to do the research.
Mm. You made one comment also about regurgitation. I think that's also kind of cool because they're one of the only predators that I know of. That will come back after the hunt and then regurgitate impala soup for the kids.
Absolutely.
Sorry.
Absolutely. And not just for the kids. They will do it for the babysitter or the alpha female who stayed behind at the den and any injured dog. I mean, I had a lovely dog called Patrick who got seriously attacked by a baboon. And, he rested by the den. I thought he was on his way out. And each time the dogs came back, we regurgitated for him. Within a week, they're incredibly tough. He was up again hunting.
That's quite touching. That's really,
It is incredible. And I think, it's one of the things that they used to love when we did the talk, because we would talk about how the wild dogs would, in fact, support, as you're saying, the injured, etc., the old and the infirm.
Yeah.
Until a certain point, and that's when the directors of companies used to love it, then they get taken out. it's almost like a self-suicide within the pack, which is sad, but everything is done for the good of the pack.
Well, I think it appeals to our human sensibilities that up until that point, they've still done as much as they can to help that pack member. Now, Nicholas, the cover of the coffee table book is how many? About five of painted wolves, sort of in line, in unison. What's this posture that? Because I'm not sure if they're sort of stalking something, or maybe earlier on you were talking about the fact that when it's time to eat, they kind of beg the alpha female for food. So I'm not sure, what is that posture of sort of begging or being submissive? What's it called in this instance?
Okay, on the front of that cover, I'm going to let you into a secret. Mm-hmm. That is the posture they take when they actually go on the hunt, when they're stalking the impala. They
stalking.
Get into a straight line, they're hunting down very low, and they're just about to launch their attack.
Mm-hmm.
But on that particular occasion, it was in Manipur, it's the Bundu pack, which is Tate was the alpha female. She was famous in Dynasty. Anyway, they woke up. They'd been sleeping under a baobab tree, and it was really, really hot. It was about nearly 50 degrees. And the pups were under a bush. And they woke up, they greeted each other gently and quietly, and then they said, come on, let's go and wake up the pups. And so they stalked along really quietly and then bounded on the pups and woke them all up. So that gives you an idea of the sort of fun that they are. But yeah. Everyone thinks that's a stalking and a hunting picture, but actually they just wanted to have fun.
Playfulness.
And then the pups woke up and thought, yay, let's have a game. And they played and then went down for water.
Speaking of pups, you've got a lovely picture in the book of pups playing with a baboon head. And it sounds grisly when I say it, but you know, they kind of exude this joy even. You know, just kids playing with their meals.
Again, that exudes their fun. I mean, that was really fortunate. I mean, that got me into the Wildlife Photographer of the Year competition, that picture. So I'm very grateful for the pups there. But in Mana Pool, it was the Nyakasanga pack, Black Tips pack, who actually developed this technique of actually hunting baboons at a time when the baboon population in Mana Pools mm-hmm. was getting out of control. So in a way, they became they were doing the ecosystem a bit of a benefit.
Yeah.
So and then once they had killed the baboons, the pups had fed on it. They thought, you know, the pups just love to have fun. And I was alone with the pups, in the pack. I was lying flat on the ground taking pictures, and they picked up this baboon pup, and they were charging. There were 9 pups all having fun with it. They even came up to me and said, do you want to join in? And it was like, no, thanks.
No, mate.
It was a lot of, I mean, it was just so much fun to see. I mean, it was not much, I mean, the baboon is gone, but it's, and that picture does say sort of like the baboons just lying, oh, just please put me down.
Gentlemen, as we wrap, Tim, you want to ask the final question?
No, I just was going to say the one thing that you do mention, we should have brought the sound in, and I'll look for one next week, is the sound of the wild dog is one of the most incredible sounds when you have a whole pack yipping away happily.
Yeah.
Nicholas, well done. It's a lovely book, and I think it's awesome. And it's great to bring, everybody jumps up and down about rhino and all sorts of other things. And just for once, bring out the old painted wolf, the wild dog.
Brilliant.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much indeed.
Nicholas Dyer, thank you so much for your time. Very, very quickly, the proceeds of the book, Painted Wolves, A Wild Dog's Life, go where?
Yeah, everything goes to the Painted Wolf Foundation. We're not benefit from ourselves. This is really trying to kickstart something to get them globally aware, mm-hmm. Raise the global awareness. So, this really is just a conservation project to try and get these guys. And, 6 years of my life dedicated to doing it. And, I really hope that, just get everyone to spread the word that these guys really need saving.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, Nicholas. It's been a pleasure.
No, lovely. Thank you so much indeed.
All right, Nicholas Dyer, wildlife photographer and nature conservationist, talking to us about his coffee table book, Painted Wolves, A Wild Dog's Life, and of course, the Painted Wolves Foundation. Tim, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. It was so much fun.
It's awesome. And, they're just wonderful creatures. And if you do go to somewhere like the Anne van Dyck Centre, if it's the only place you're going to ever see dogs, go and have a look at them.
Yeah.
And, a friend of mine, Paul Mills, actually filmed the first, well, the only, I think, birth.
Yeah.
Of wild dogs.
Oh, wow.
And that was at the center where the dogs were in an underground den, and they put in cameras, and it was awesome.
And beautiful too.
They are beautiful creatures, and each one is unique. And that pattern, mm-hmm. it's actually fascinating. A friend of mine's painting wild dogs at the moment, and it's fascinating to see how from a pup that pattern is there, and you can actually take a matrix and identify each dog by its pattern on its coat.
Fascinating stuff. Tim Neary, we'll chat again next week, Sunday.